to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the program that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm extremely pleased to have with me today in the studio on University Matters, Dr. Stella Borges-Barthe. Just a few words about my guest. Dr. Borges-Barthe read for a BA Honours in English here at the University of Malta back in 1979. After a number of years of teaching, she decided to read for her Master's and then followed this up with her PhD in 1997. By this time, of course, Dr. Borges-Barthe was already a full-time lecturer in the Department of English at the University of Malta. Her main research interests are in post-colonial theory and the post-colonial novel, with a special interest in African and Australian writing. In fact, her PhD thesis was entitled Myth and History in the West African Novel, and I hope we'll talk a little bit about that. This interest led her to be involved in and organise the 2005 edition of the Triennial Conference of the European Association for Commonwealth Literature and Language Studies. She was later their Public Relations Officer for Southern Europe and is now the Secretary of EACLAS, a rather difficult acronym. Welcome to you, Dr. Borges-Barthe. Since we are friends, I'm going to take the liberty of calling you Stella. That was a very potted version of your beautiful CV, but I thought we'd leave more time to talk about this fascinating subject. I was interested to note in our correspondence prior to this interview that you referred to Commonwealth and post-colonial literature. Perhaps you could set the scene with regard to a definition of Commonwealth literature, Commonwealth literary studies, as they're sometimes known in universities, and explain the difference between the two terms, if indeed there is one.
Well, the Commonwealth literature emerged in the mid-60s. I think one of the first centres was Leeds. In fact, Ngugi wa Thiong'o was at Leeds at that time, and we'll talk about Ngugi a little bit later. Here in Malta, I was introduced to Commonwealth literature way back in the 1970s. Of course, if you use the word Commonwealth, then you are thinking of writing emerging from countries that are part of the Commonwealth. If you use the term post-colonial, and it is used more widely now, then you are, first of all, focusing on the writing post-independence. You know, there is this emphasis, I think, in that word on the ending of the colonial, on independence, on the sort of post-colonial moment. But even so, you know, the term post-colonial is hugely contested, you know, with interpretations of the term going from the geographical to the temporal, you know, to the historical, and sort of even more openly and perhaps more usefully as the kind of writing that emerges from groups that are dominated, that are searching for a separate identity. You know, in that more open interpretation, it allows then, you know, to see different literatures emerging at different times and from different places. I must say here that with the Commonwealth, for example, using sort of the Commonwealth as a definition, went quite a way towards establishing a sort of most unnatural rift between Anglophone studies and Francophone studies. And this has continued to be so, even because of the way that post-colonial studies were also departmentalized, in the sense that Francophone studies were normally carried out in French departments and Anglophone studies in English departments. And it is only, I would say, in the last 10 years that I begin to see attempts to bring the two together. I mean, not just here in Malta, but even internationally.
I suppose the post-colonial, as you say, you can be talking about post-French colonial, you could be also talking about post-Portuguese colonial.
It is more open and has been much more closely theorized than the Commonwealth ever was. In a sense, I suppose one could see the emphasis on theory as having been also, to some point, at some a disadvantage. You know, I think it is always healthy to return, recurrently almost return to the creative, to return, in fact, to the study of the literature actually emerging.
A provocative question, really, but which we've sort of touched on, is that. Is it really right to define the literatures of different countries under one umbrella? I think I'm paraphrasing Rushdie in Commonwealth Literature Does Not Exist in saying that Commonwealth literature is a ghost created by the critics to pigeonhole a certain form of writing. By classifying this way, critics are focusing on a fabricated construction as opposed to literature in and of itself.
I would agree with Rajdi to a certain extent, but there are other ways of pigeonholing. You know, for example, nationality is another way of pigeonholing. I mean, why is it that students studying drama, for example, would not be studying restoration drama, for example, along with the kind of drama that was so successful in France around the same time? You know, I think that it is a pity, really, that we have been led to cut English literature from the rest. It is only, I mean, in the last couple of years, really, that the department, my department of English, has started offering courses in world literature. Because I think that it does help a great deal, you know, whatever literature you are studying, if you put it within the context of, you know. So my point, really, at the moment is that every other way, in a sense, pigeonholes. I mean, nationality as, you know, English literature, Italian literature, is also a way of pigeonholing. If you take, but it's all literature, then again you're pigeonholing. You are foregrounding the literary at the expense of the social, the political, the historical. You know, so whatever you do, you're always going to be limiting.
Since our history here, at least colonial history, is British, the English have always been very keen on studying their own, you know, languages. Other languages have never been their strong point, really. So maybe our tradition, even as a university, in the 164 years of colonial rule, was, you know, to learn about the English side of things rather than anything. And perhaps that sort of got carried on a bit too far, perhaps.
I don't know whether it's... I don't think that we are learning too much English, let me put it this way. I think that there is a case, however, for saying that departmentalization, of course there are events, there are ideas that are shared between one department and another, but I think we could do with more interdepartmental organization, with more interdepartmental cooperation, particularly post-colonial studies.
With regard in particular to your particular interests in Australian literature, it struck me, reading what you'd sent me in preparation for this interview, again, Australia has gone through many stages of development. From the British point of view, it started off as a penal colony, but of course, obviously, it had people there before then. Then there was the influx of the people from mostly from Britain and Anglo-Saxon.
Celtic, the
Irish. And then now with different nationalities. So Australia has become a melting pot. So it must be very interesting to look at that particular continent and try and understand what's going on in the literature there.
It is indeed a very interesting literature. But what I wanted to sort of justify is my own choice of furthering research both in Australian writing. and in African writing. I mean, this wasn't a choice that I made easily, in the sense that I was interested in other literatures. For example, Indian literature is very, very interesting, but you know, there's a limit to what you can do. Even with this, with my limitation, I am, you know, by international standards, a sort of jack of all trades, even because I don't do this all the time. You know, I also do, with great love, I teach 18th century novel, 19th century novel, 19th century American novel, you know, so I am quite, you know, quite spread. But the choice of Australian and African was based on the fact that Australian writing tended to be highly sophisticated. You have two different kinds of colonization there. You have in Africa, generally and typically, sort of exploitation. Colonization to exploit, whereas in Australia and in Canada you have settler colonization, where the presence is going to be much stronger. I mean, for a start, you can see this in the fact that Australian writing is written in English. African writing, the one I read, is written in English, but it has to be to be in a contest with writing in many other languages. So, you know, the fact that I wanted to allow for my own concern for the literary necessitated that I should continue researching both Australian writing, which is sort of writing, sometimes very nationalist, it is true, but writing that is as complex as anything in contemporary fiction in England and in Britain and the US. And African writing, where you have a variety, you have the same kind of complex writing. I mean, one need only mention, for example, in South Africa, the writings of Coetzee, for example, or Nadine Gordimer. At the same time, you also have to deal with writers who are challenged by the huge rate of illiteracy. One can mention here the famous case of Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who, after writing Petals of Blood in 1978, made his famous farewell to the English language, in the conviction that by using the English language, he was in the process of building up a Kenyan identity, inscribing within the writing its own destruction, simply by writing in English. It isn't just Ngugi who has felt ill at ease at the written English word. You know, when you look at the way that many writers turn to drama with dramatic results.
Well, that makes sense. If you have an audience that is not literate, then the drama genre would certainly be a very effective way of getting your message across, one presumes.
And the message does come across very, very strongly, because just a year after writing Petals of Blood, Ngugi wa Thiong'o presented a play, I Will Marry When I Want, in the Gikuyu language. And the police descended on the theater. He was arrested, kept in detention for a year without any actual accusation. And after that, he had to escape from Kenya, and he remained in Europe and in America until 2004. And then he returned, and while he was there, he was attacked in the hotel, you know, where he was. And his wife was severely beaten.
Well, that, obviously, the written word is always there's always a risk. You're always running a risk with the written word. But going back to Australia for a moment, because
that really
interested me. You've got this melting pot. Who are the main protagonists? Who who is writing at the moment? Where do they come from? I mean, in an Australian bookshop, what kind of local, writing, in inverted commas, writing would you find at the moment?
Well, I mean, there are writers like Tim Winton, for example, who's popular. You have biographies, especially, you know, from migrants. I'm particularly interested in migrant writing, but there are other writers. I'll come to the migrants in a moment. I mean, I am deeply interested in, for example, David Malouf, whose father was in fact Lebanese, and whose writing has this beautiful lyrical quality that you know, sort of invites attention to the literary. Although the political is also there in Malouf. Writers like Patrick White, who passed away now quite a few years ago, but whose writing is really, really major. You know, he's a Nobel Prize winner for literature. But I'm sure that readers will be reading Patrick White long after many others will have been forgotten.
The dust, yes.
Yes, 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 yes. Or Peter Carey, for example. Peter Carey, who has a very high profile throughout the world. In fact, that is the strong point, I think, with Australian writing, is that there are writers who are very keen on making their presence felt in Australia. You know, someone like Thomas Keneally, although he is also widely read throughout the world. I mean, I need only mention Schindler's List. But in other novels, Keneally consciously wrote sort of the kind of novel that would build the nation. His beautiful novel Bring Larks and Heroes, for example, or even The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. Yes, writing is very varied in Australia. You know, you have Aboriginal writers like Sally Morgan, for example, who is highly successful.
There are those who are using their writing to emphasize the post-coloniality of their present state. Some of them are trying to... Some of them have Republican tendencies.
Yes, Keneally himself.
What messages are they trying to put across?
Keneally is one of the foremost Republicans. He even headed the movement at one point, I believe. So, you know, he is strongly in favor of putting forward this white nation. You know, he has been criticized, in fact, for putting forward this white nation. Dominated not quite by the Anglo-Saxon but by the Celtic. One of the political elements that emerge from Malouf, even if his best novels have this, you know, beautiful lyrical quality, is that the division, the sharp division that existed in his own childhood right up to the 40s and 50s between Irish and Anglo-Saxon in Australia, between Catholic. In fact, although Malouf was not Irish, he writes of having been Irish by virtue of being Catholic, you know, in Australia, because the division was so sharp and so neat between Anglo-Saxon and Irish, between Protestant and Catholic. And his novels, for example, Remembering Babylon or The Conversations at Carlow Creek. The Conversations of Carlow Creek suggests that whether it is Catholic or Protestant, there is the forefathers of the nation, far from being guilty, have earned their right to Australia. You know,
so there are these issues that are still being brought up, even though
it's a land issue, Tisha, because there is a movement in Australia, a very strong movement, to give huge tracts of land back to the Aborigines. Now, of course, Republicans have been favoring this return of the land, mostly, I would think, or perhaps they are, let us say, influenced by the fact that a lot of this land is actually in Anglo-Saxon hands, because it was the English who went there not as convicts. And in fact, you know, someone like Keneally is very proud of his convict ancestry, you know, he really emphasizes it, flaunts it, absolutely. Whereas the emigrants, the English immigrants tended to be landowning, you know, sheep, wool ranch owners. So, you know, those huge tracts of land would be taken away, in fact, from you know, the Anglo-Saxon rather than from the Celtic.
I think what you said about Ngugi wa Thiong'o idea of discarding the English language is something that must resonate here in Malta, because clearly we've had a language question vis-a-vis literature. How do you see that sentiment fitting in with the post-colonial Commonwealth literature of our own?
It resonates very, very strongly. You know, the language issue is, I think, the key issue, even in post-colonial studies, because it connects with the deepest aspects of our being. You know, language connects with the deepest aspects of our being. And in fact, bilinguals like myself will still do some things in one language and others in another language.
Is that a question of what audience you are trying to reach?
Audience, of course, comes into it, but also emotion, sentiment. I mean, I would generally feel that much more close in certain ambits, let us say the religious. Prayer, for example, is where my own Maltese language would certainly be my preferred language there, and it says something, I think, you know, that having said that, however, I am strongly in favor of Maltese people being able to choose what to write, and to write in more than one language. In fact, one of the things that I am very happy to have started in the Department of English is a course on Maltese writing in English. I think that for me the most iconic figure is Francis Abeyer, you know, Francis Abeyer, who wrote dramas both in Maltese and in English, has some very successful plays in Maltese, like El Hatfu El Bayt, for example. Brilliant, you know, Maltese. He could write brilliant Maltese. But the novels that he wrote in English, very interesting novels that some of my students are reading now, along with the work of contemporary writers who are opting to write in English. People like Vincent Vella, for example, Petra Bianchi. And this has also helped me to connect with migrant writing in Australia. I had long been interested in migrant writing in Australia. For example, Gaita, Raymond Gaita, whose father is Romanian. And
Maltese.
There are a number of Maltese writers writing in English. Roseanne Dingley, who's based in Perth. And then there is Lou Drofenik. Lou Drofenik Louise Zammit. She left Malta in 1962 under the single woman scheme and went on to become, you know, a very good writer, in my opinion. She has published about 4 novels so far, and I am teaching one of her novels on my course on Maltese writing in English. This is Birds of Passage.
In the last minutes that we have, perhaps we could touch on what's going to happen vis-a-vis writing with the Arab Spring.
Yes, yes. In fact, I don't know where all the time has gone to. Because
countertext.
Because I certainly would have liked to say more about language and how it affects you know, the Maltese. But I think, anyway, to think about the Arab Spring, I mean, this is I have for a time been interested in writing emerging from North Africa. I have read quite a bit of Egyptian writing, but now with this Arab Spring, the challenge is not only, you know, here in Malta, but I think to post-colonialism as a whole. In fact, I am very, very happy that my department, that it produces a journal, Countertext, and I have been asked to co-edit with my younger colleague, Norbert Bujeya, a special edition on post-colonial springs, where we are going to be highlighting the cultural turmoil, I should say, that must arise, turmoil, the cultural representations, I suppose, emerging from this Arab Spring. Obviously, this will take more than another year in the preparation.
I was going to say, what's the time frame?
No. I mean, I think one needs to have the dust settle quite a bit. My own contribution, I think, will tend to focus on Libya. I am interested in writing in emerging from Libya, and I hope to be able to you know, insert. But there is, you know, I mean, a number of other areas that will be very, very interesting.
Well, we look forward to seeing this Countertext when it comes out. And I'd like to thank Dr. Stella Borges-Barthe for joining us on University Matters today. Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.